Hello and welcome to A Problem Squared, the podcast where we solve people's problems. Coming to you from a festival this time.
Yes.
Because A Problem Squared is a lot like being at a festival. You show up some headline acts you want to hear from, but yeah, it's the unexpected bits that make the experience. In our case, are the problems. My name is Matt Parker. I am the overly prepared festival goer who has all the things I want to see in a spreadsheet. I'm joined by Beck Hill, who dresses every day like she's at a festival.
It's true. I had so many compliments yesterday on my outfit, and I had to explain to people that that is my normal clothes.
Your regular wardrobe.
Like, I love your dinosaur tracksuit and bright pink trench coat. I'm like, yep.
Yep.
Yep, this is what I normally wear.
Clothes.
Yeah, just my standard clothes.
On this episode,
we'll be solving some mini festival problems.
I've run the numbers on carbon dioxide and cycling.
And there's so many other business.
Oof.
Some really good stuff.
In the any other business tent.
Yeah.
The same tent we're in now.
Yeah. It's all taking place in the Problem Squared tent.
So, Beck, I want to quickly say hello to new listeners, because we know people join us on any given episode, and you're always welcome. We do not normally record at a festival. We normally record in a studio with much better microphones and less tent rustling. However, probably one of the biggest limiting factors of A Problem Squared is Beck and I aligning our schedules. And we were both working at the same festival.
Yes.
And we figured, hey, if we're both here at the big festival doing shows anyway, why don't we use a bit of our downtime? Because we were struggling to find a day otherwise.
Well, somebody is very busy writing a book.
That happens.
So selfishly.
I do apologize.
I mean, to be fair, the book was far before we started.
That's true, but people should appreciate that the reduction in audio quality they're experiencing now and the background noise from the main stage, which is inescapable, is resulting in a 0.5% increase in quality of my next book. So your suffering is an ultimate net gain, assuming you also read the book.
Yeah. Sure, I trust you.
So, Beck, how are you enjoying the big festival?
I'm having a great time. Yesterday, I hosted Comedy Club for Kids.
You did? I saw that.
I'd started off by briefly mentioning that I'm from Australia, and then I was asking children, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And a girl near the front of the stage put her hand up, and I said, what would you like? And she said, teleportation.
Yep.
And I said, great, what would you do? And she said, I'd visit my family because they live very far away. So, oh, that's lovely.
I had the same thought as you. I'm like, they're overseas.
Yeah, that's great.
Distant family. I know the feeling.
I said, oh, where do your family live?
Yep.
And she said, Telford.
Telford.
Which is a place in the UK.
Yeah. It's going to take a couple of hours to drive there, depending on where you live.
Yeah.
It's a long way.
Yeah, it's for a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no.
How far is that? It's like 3 or 4 Bluey episodes length.
Yeah. Another kid said that for their superpower, they wanted a very strong seagull. And I was like, oh, what, just like as a pet? And they said, yeah. And I said, what would you call it? And he just went, John.
That's a good name for a very strong
John
seagull.
John the Strong Seagull. Yeah. There was another kid who said that they would want to be able to transform into a seal to annoy me. And I was like, well, joke's on you, mate, because seals clap. And I love applause.
You love a good applause. Yeah. Look at that. That's the quick thinking you get paid
That's
for.
How I
back.
Get my seal of approval.
Hey.
Yeah, so that was very fun. And then we did an evening of unnecessary detail.
Yep, which is one of the main things I was here to do, host that.
Yeah, you did a great job.
The first year they've had a spoken word stage. Mm. And so they said, do you want to come and do an evening of unnecessary detail? And so it was you, me, Helen Arnie, and Steve Mould.
Yep.
A lot of fun. Oh, and Alex James.
Yeah, he supported me.
He was your warm-up.
He was my warm-up act.
Yeah. Alex James, people unfamiliar, bass player from the band Blur, owns the field we're currently sat in.
Yes.
Hosts the big festival. Massive mass nerd. And so I think it might have been him behind the scenes why they got us involved.
Yes.
And so we gave him a spot to talk about cheese making, which is one of
his
passions.
Which was fascinating.
He had a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Simon Pegg was DJing.
Oh, and Simon Pegg was there.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very surreal moment because we walked upstairs to the special
friends of Alex
James
zone.
Yep. Zone. Gav, my husband, was with us. And as soon as he stepped upstairs, Alex James came up to him and said, have some of this steak sandwich. It's delicious. Gav was like, well, I'm not going to turn it down.
That sounds like him.
Yeah. And it was. He let me have a bite as well.
Yeah.
But Gav ate most of it. It was great. Yeah, it was very fun. Simon Pegg came up and danced upstairs for a bit after you guys left.
Oh, yeah. He's a fun guy. He was at the back when we were sneaking off. Yeah.
It was very cool.
What a festival.
I didn't want to say hello. I wanted to be cool.
Ah, yeah. That's first rule of VIP zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep it real cool.
Yeah. I think that I always like to think that if I'm going to meet someone properly, it's going to be on the same level.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've just got to wait.
But one of the other performers came up to you and said that their kid's a big fan of your show.
Yes.
So yeah, it balances out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true.
To circle a big fan.
There's a certain level of fame where you know you shouldn't bother people. And I'm not at that level
no,
yet.
You're definitely in the botherable zone.
Yes, please bother me. I still need that very much.
Speaking of problems, as we were recording, it started raining and we are in a tent. So right now, Beck has clambered outside the tent to roll down the front so we don't get rained on. There we go. So I guess that's our first problem. How have we both been dealing with rain?
Well, the first thing that I did just then was zip up the front of the tent.
Oh.
If you don't zip up the tent, it floods, as Gav and I found out yesterday.
Oh, from personal experience.
Yeah. It came down real heavy during Comic Club Kids.
Came out of nowhere.
Proper hail and everything. So my first way of solving a problem is if you're camping, zip up your tent.
I think the bigger issue is never assume the weather's going to continue to be the same. I have really been risking it this time. I didn't bring like my waterproof coat with me.
Ooh.
Or like my waterproof gumboots or anything like that, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've gone right before I came to the festival. I looked up online right before I came to the festival. I looked up online all the weather data from the Met Office to work out the chance of rain and when it's going to happen. And I decided it was low enough.
Not to believe it.
Infrequent enough that I would be fine with a light jacket.
Ah.
I solved this problem. Well, not this problem, but this kind of suite of problems by deciding I'm now too old for staying in a tent unnecessarily.
Well, I don't normally camp.
Yeah.
You know this.
Yes.
Because my rule, and I have almost definitely mentioned this on the podcast before.
Yeah.
My rule with camping is that I love camping, but I think it's only worth it when you are not near a bed.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I think camping, if I'm going to camp, it's because it's allowing me to do something I couldn't otherwise do.
Yes.
Be somewhere I couldn't be, experience something I couldn't experience. I don't want to rough it for the sake of it when I could afford a nearby hotel.
Yeah.
And so Lucy and I, we couldn't get, there's not that many very close hotels. So we're staying several miles away, but I brought my bike. We hired Lucy an e-bike and we have been just commuting backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
It's great.
We could not afford a hotel. I did consider commuting just on the trains.
Oh, wow.
Because this festival is right next to a train station.
Yep.
But there were rail strikes.
Oh, yeah. That's not
so
good.
On the day I was performing. So we needed to be here.
Yeah.
And so we took the pre-pitched tent.
Wise.
Mainly because I don't drive. We don't have a car. So we would have had to hire a car. That gets expensive. And
Lucy and I came on the train 1 year. To this festival and we brought our pop-up tent and a self-inflating mattress.
Oh, hello.
But it was right on the cusp of how much stuff you can carry on a train to a festival, because a pop-up tent goes up fast but doesn't pack down small.
No.
So it was a big chunky tent to lug. Big.
Yeah.
Likewise, self-inflating mattress goes up easy, but when you roll it down, it's still massive.
Yeah.
Because it's full of foam. It's basically a foam mattress inside an air mattress.
Got it.
And you squeeze all the air out of the foam and then plug it before the air gets back in.
Like how mattresses are sent in the post now.
Like how mattresses are sent in the post. So anyway, I think e-bikes are part of what's made that possible.
Mm.
And I think e-bikes are one of the best things that's happening to cycling in a long time. Because anyone can just jump on a bike and you can get to and from without being sweaty. Doesn't matter if you've got different levels of, not fitness, but I cycle a lot and Lucy doesn't cycle much. She used to cycle a lot more previously, but because we can hire her an e-bike, she goes up and down the hills way faster than I can. She just turns up the motor assist and she's off, and so it means we can, you know, commute by bike to the festival. It's been great.
This problem comes from Dakota, who says, I'm fortunate enough to be in a city with a vast network of dedicated bike trails. and only have to cross the street once during their commute when they're cycling.
Got it.
Luckily, there is a crosswalk signal specifically for the trail.
Oh, amazing.
My question is, how many average US vehicles would have to be stopped by me crossing the road? So I'm assuming this means that if there's no one there at the crossing, then the cars just run freely.
Yes.
Yeah. That my carbon emissions savings would be cancelled out. So if I drove to work rather than biking, it is around a 15-minute trip, just over 4.5 miles.
Good problem, Dakota. Because if you cycle to work, but you cause a huge tailback of traffic that produce more exhaust, more carbon dioxide, than if you had just driven to work and been traffic yourself.
Yeah.
Then the environmental benefit of cycling is gone.
Yeah, you still got the health benefits.
Still got the health benefits.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking you're reducing your carbon footprint, you're not. Now, there are three things we need to know here. There's how much carbon dioxide would Dakota have produced driving to work.
Okay.
There's how much carbon dioxide does a car produce while idling and waiting for someone to use the crosswalk.
Yes.
And finally, that's how much carbon dioxide does Dakota produce while cycling. Because it's not free. You're using energy.
Your own energy.
Yeah. But you've got to eat more food or burn fat to do the additional exercise required.
Yeah.
And to cycle.
We breathe out.
We breathe out carbon dioxide.
Huh.
So I thought I'd start with working out how much carbon dioxide Dakota produces. Now, there are different types of energy production in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to go with burning fat, just because personally I tend to cycle as a weight loss approach.
Yep.
And I appreciate you can eat carbs and burn them immediately. I went for the amount of carbon dioxide produced when you burn 1 kilogram of fat. And there's some research done into this about 10 years ago that for every 1 kilo of fat you burn, 2.8 kilos of carbon dioxide come out of your body.
Oh my gosh.
That's a lot.
So the weight that you're losing is actually carbon dioxide.
Yeah. You lose weight through breath.
Yeah.
Well, not entirely. It's a bit over, it's around 85%-ish, might be 86%, of the mass you lose, you breathe out.
What?
And the remaining, like, 14% is through extra liquid. So weight loss is breathing. I mean, you can't lose more weight just by breathing more.
So
you got to burn it gets the fat to breathe it out.
Converted into energy.
Yep.
So the energy is what you're using to ride the bike.
Yep.
But the weight that is lost is not from the energy itself.
Not from the energy itself.
It's from the byproduct of creating the energy.
Yep.
Oh, my mind has just been blown.
But the reason why you...
So if I just breathe more, will I lose weight? If I just breathe twice as much as I do normally...
No, you need to be exercising because you can breathe more, but you're not adding more carbon dioxide in. It's not just the act of breathing, it's the amount of carbon dioxide ready to go.
Okay, yeah.
So when you're exercising, there's a higher percentage of carbon dioxide in what you're breathing out.
Got it.
And that's where you're losing the weight.
Yeah.
And it's subtly different because there's one way of looking at it is for every kilogram of fat, where does that mass end up once you've lost it? Mm. And that's I think it's 86% you breathe out and 14% you wee out or perspire.
Wow.
But then if you look at the actual mass of carbon dioxide you produce, it's more than a kilogram because you've got to breathe in a bunch of oxygen to then produce the carbon dioxide.
Mm.
So if you're just looking at, for fat loss, carbon dioxide out, 2.8 kilograms of carbon dioxide breathed out for every 1 kilogram of fat burnt.
Mm.
Kilogram of fat burnt, the whole process of doing that uses 9,400 kcal, which I'm going to call calories from here in.
Yes.
So you can now work out, for a certain number of calories spent cycling, how much carbon dioxide you'll breathe out.
Yeah.
Assuming it's going through the fat-burning pathway.
Because it takes quite a lot to burn calories. Like, we burn calories naturally throughout the day.
Yes.
Just through existing.
The one thing I haven't compared it to, because I figured the time scale was too short, is the baseline calorie burn from just existing. I haven't subtracted that off.
Right.
I've just looked at the calories you burn while cycling. I haven't compensated for if you were sitting on the sofa instead.
I see. Yeah.
People are welcome to do that. As you're going to find out in a moment, doesn't matter.
Okay. All right.
So I then realized I'm commuting by bike at the moment, and it's about 3 or 4 miles to cycle into the festival site.
Mm.
So I thought on my way in this morning, I would put on my heart rate monitor and the sensors on the bike and get it to calculate how many calories it takes me to cycle onto site.
Yeah.
So I can then use that. But I don't know anything else about Dakota. So I thought I'd just use my stats for this.
Yeah.
And it took me, it's 3.78 mile cycle, and that used 88 calories.
Yeah.
Which is not much.
No, it's like, if you try and purposefully go, I'm going to burn this, the amount of calories that, like, I've been eating donuts.
You have been, during the podcast, before during and during, yeah. And I predict after.
Yeah, well predicted. So if I was like, well, I'm going to go and dance this off while listening to some music or something, I probably won't be able to do that just by dancing, unless I dance for the entire day.
You have to do a lot. Well, when I cycle at home, I cycle deliberately energy-intensive routes. So I've got a few cycle laps I do, which are all vaguely 10 miles near my house. You can get out and do them in under an hour. And they're ones where I'm going up and down hills, doing off-road stuff. And so actually I looked up my most recent cycle at home, which is 11.3 miles. And that took 676 calories. Because I'm going up and down the Surrey Hills.
Yeah.
That's off-road. That's a section of that's in sand cycling.
Wow.
Which is a whole thing. So then I was averaging 59.8 calories a mile.
That's
like 60 calories a mile, as opposed to the ride in here, which was 23 calories a mile.
Mm.
So it was pretty much almost a 3-to-1 difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the terrain. So I've worked it out for both. I've worked it out for the 60 calorie miles, which is like a worst case, I imagine. Because, well, I know there are more intense ways. I don't cycle that hard. And I've worked it out for the leisurely commute, because where I'm staying, it's uphill of the site here.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of the ride in was rolling down a hill.
Right.
So I'm not surprised it was so low on the calories. I worked it out for both. I then took my results, my difficult ride and my easy ride.
Yep.
Compared them to the calories from burning fat, scaled them to match the length of Dakota's commute.
Okay.
And then ran all the numbers. And if Dakota's commute is nice and easy, like my riding this morning, then they will produce about 31 grams of carbon dioxide.
Okay.
On the commute. 0.03 kilograms, let's say. If it's a difficult ride, 80 grams of carbon dioxide.
Okay.
But now you're thinking, what if they drove instead?
Mm.
So because this is in the US, I looked up on the official EPA website from the government in the USA, and they say, on average, because it depends on the car, depends on how fast you're driving, depends on the speeds, so many factors. And I was like, how am I going to get an average? The EPA have their official average.
Great.
It's 0.4 kilos a mile of carbon dioxide.
Quite a lot.
Quite a lot.
Mm.
Which means Dakota's drive, on average in the USA, will produce 1.8 kilograms of carbon dioxide.
Okay.
Compared to, worst case scenario, 80 grams.
Yeah.
So it almost wasn't worth balancing out the carbon dioxide produced by cycling, because it's so much less. The human body and bicycles are both very efficient machines.
Yeah.
Particularly compared to a combustion engine.
Yep.
That we use almost no energy compared to going in a car.
Mm.
And that's before you get to the fact that if you're eating food and cycling, that's carbon, which was already in the carbon cycle, very recently went into food, got eaten, reproduced, whereas fossil fuels are getting all new carbon that's been locked away and putting it into the carbon cycle. So it's not even comparing apples to apples. It's comparing apples to fossilized oranges because you're bringing in carbon dioxide that wasn't there originally when you're burning fuel versus eating food is just carbon dioxide that's already on the go. Now, I looked up, according to the National Association of City Transportation Officials, how much carbon dioxide is produced by a car idling.
Because
that's going to be different to driving at speed.
Yeah.
So I, instead of needing mass per mile driven, I now needed mass per time interval sat doing nothing.
Yeah.
And you produce 0.588 grams of carbon dioxide per second.
Ooh, that's a lot.
It isn't. It's 2.1 kilos an hour.
Okay.
So a car sat idling for an hour is about the same as having driven 5 miles.
Okay.
At regular speeds, much quicker than an hour.
Yeah.
So it's not as bad as driving. But you're still putting out over 2 kilos an hour just sat there.
And how long on average would you say a crossing time is?
That's a great question, Beck. Mm. Well, thank goodness the people at the National Association of City Transportation Officials.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Which I looked up also in the US.
Fantastic.
They recommend, because this is not traffic lights for traffic, it's specifically a crosswalk, where you're stopping traffic just for the purpose of someone crossing.
Yeah.
And they recommend crosswalks, depending on the situation, are ideally between 60 to 90 seconds
of
traffic stopped time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've now got an upper and a lower bound. So I did this for 60 and 90 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it for the tough cycle and the easy cycle, even though they're almost indistinguishable now, to work out our upper and lower bounds. So you know what? We just do it. We'll do it for the worst case difficult cycle, and we will compare it to both 60 and 90 seconds of stop time at a crosswalk. And if it was a difficult cycle, so you're producing lots of carbon dioxide anyway, and it was the shortest stop, so only 60 seconds, then it would take 48.7 cars being stopped by the crosswalk for the whole 60 seconds to cancel out the carbon dioxide saved by cycling.
Yeah.
If it was a 90 second one, which would be more idle time, even worse, then that would be 32.5 cars.
And this is for each trip?
For each trip.
Yeah.
So if on the way in, for the single crossing, 33 cars have to stop for the full 90 seconds, that's more carbon dioxide produced
than you'd save.
Than you'd save from cycling.
But that's quite a lot of cars.
It's a lot of cars, and that's the full 90 seconds.
Yeah.
30 cars? Depends what the road is that they're crossing, I guess.
Yeah, like I've heard that the traffic in LA is awful. There's a lot of traffic jams and stuff. So potentially, you know, it could be something like that. But realistically,
with this
especially if it's a road that has a pedestrian crossing, because a lot of the time if you're going to get that many cars, they're going to build a bridge or something or an underpass.
Infrastructure is always the answer.
Yeah, because they wouldn't have a multi-lane thing, because that means there's a lot of cars.
No, if you have to stop that many cars, you wouldn't have a crosswalk.
Exactly, yeah.
For this exact reason.
Yeah.
It's inconveniencing a lot of people. And this is assuming Dakota's the only person crossing.
Yeah.
But it's closer than I thought.
Yeah, because if Dakota rocks up to that crossing and there's multiple other cyclists crossing at the same time.
That's better, yes.
And they're not driving, then you're significantly...
Then you're way in front, yeah.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is I didn't really comprehend, because cars idling still produce so much carbon dioxide, and I've not looked into like cars that turn themselves off.
Mm.
Obviously, that would be great.
Yeah.
But this is assuming the cars are running the whole time. Then it's very easy to cancel out the savings by stopping a bunch of cars and making them idle for a while. You're inadvertently producing a lot of carbon dioxide. So it's definitely a consideration worth making.
Yeah. It isn't something that I would have thought of, but it's like when you hear things about, and I need to look into this, but you hear things about how like recycled toilet paper potentially produces more carbon than...
Yeah.
Than other ones, because the other ones require us to grow trees, so the trees take out a lot of the carbon dioxide, whereas the recycling one requires a lot of energy in order to
clean it and bleach it and all this jazz. There's always more factors. And it's not like the answer this time, like the answer, if it was like 1,000 cars or 10,000 cars, then that would be like, oh, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
But on the order of, you know, 30 to 50 cars, we're like, oh, okay, this is a factor, and that's why good cycling infrastructure is important.
So if there were more crossings than just one,
then it would add up even worse. Yeah.
So if you are a cyclist and you often have to stop traffic in a way that wouldn't naturally stop for other traffic.
Yep. You're undoing all your good work.
You could be undoing your work environmentally.
That is
assuming that you're the only cyclist. Yeah,
that's very true.
Cool.
Anyway, that's the answer. Between 32.5 and 48.75 cars.
Incredible.
Thank you.
I'm going to give that a big old ding.
Big old bicycle bell ding ding.
Yeah. Ding ding.
Time for any other business in the business tent. And the band on the main stage are getting louder, so we're going to wrap this up reasonably efficiently.
Any other big festival.
Any other big festival. And us talking about parity between food items and people caused a lot of conversation on the problem posing page at aproblemsquared.com.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of you thought you'd be very smart, very funny, very clever to point out that a food source where there is as many food items available as there are people is people.
People.
Yeah.
One-to-one, humans to humans.
Do you know what? I put this on the same level as when, talking about my kids set earlier, one of the, you know, as I said, I ask kids what superpower they want.
Yep.
There's always one smart aleck who says, I want the superpower to have all superpowers.
Oh, yeah, or infinite wishes.
Infinite wishes. Yeah. And you go, cool, I can't do anything with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like, I think it's because there's part of me, look, I'm not trying to shame you for writing in, but also I am, because I think we all know this.
I don't know.
Assumed.
It's right.
Yes.
It's very right.
Yes.
Exactly one-to-one.
If we were all cannibals.
That's true.
Which we're not. Even if you were to
but
say,
strictly
like,
speaking,
but milk.
I'm going to give them technically correct.
Yeah, technically correct.
Which
but
is
also,
the best type of correct.
We don't, it's not something we all eat.
No,
and
that's
I think
true.
That's the thing.
Fine. Well, thank you. Thank you for everyone who thought of it and put it in.
Yeah.
I say water.
Look, I'd rather people wrote in than didn't.
There you go.
Yeah.
Also, I've been back to England last week last night.
Yeah, that's true.
So you're a bit less tolerant.
I'm grumpy because it was very cold last night.
So people mentioned all sorts of food products, like fruit that didn't exist until we crossed other types of fruit,
yeah,
grain, or things that have, you know, that we've domesticated. And it's a great point. People pointed out the intermediate value theorem. If you've got something that's changing continuously, which you could argue for the case of fruit is whole values, we'll ignore that. And you know it starts below, ends up above.
Mm.
At some point, it must have gone through every value in between.
Yes.
So, the theory is, assuming the new food products over the last 10,000 or so years that have come in below the human population, at some point as they pass the human population, would have been equal to it. And I will accept statistical arguments that that's happened to so many different food products, one of them would have been exactly bang on at some point in time.
Yes.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah, that is a very good point. But I also want to give a special shout out to Eric G, who wrote in and said, I'm proud to announce that I have made a huge Excel spreadsheet on strawberry
good
production.
Good work, Eric G.
I figure I'd check when the strawberries were in season in every producing country.
So good. Ah, Eric.
Doing a Dexter.
Yep.
Assuming that these countries produce an equal amount per month in season, I could calculate how many strawberries that should exist during every month. Now, obviously, not all countries will produce an equal amount.
No.
But...
And seasons vary from place to place.
Yes. But I think that's more what we're looking at, isn't it?
Yeah.
This took time, of course, but I noticed something very interesting. Very few countries produce strawberries in October.
Oh.
So I stopped what I was doing and only checked the statistics for October. The result, possibly, on a certain day in October, there just might be less than 66,000 tons of strawberries in existence.
Right.
If a strawberry weighs 15 grams each...
Yep.
That would equal 5 billion strawberries. Fewer strawberries than people.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I got so excited when discovering this, so I have not verified my calculations at all.
Oh, don't.
I will
don't
do
break
that
it.
Some other day.
That's incredible.
We really appreciate that.
So by the intermediate value theorem for strawberries...
Yeah.
It dips below the number of humans every October. It's definitely above it.
Yeah.
When Wimbledon's on.
Yeah.
It must, at some point, there must be exactly one strawberry per human on Earth.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. That's
Eric
incredible
G.
work. Now, one thing that I believe didn't make the edit in episode 66. A lot of stuff doesn't make the edit. But one bit that I know Lauren does an incredible job making sure that...
Oh my goodness, it's a difficult choice.
Yeah, yeah. She tries to get it to within a listenable amount of time rather than just us rambling on. But I had the realization that my idea of what a ton is vastly different
than what an actual ton is.
To what an actual ton is.
A cubic meter of water.
Yeah, yeah. So I had no idea that a ton is a cubic meter of water. So I'd always been imagining like a shipping container.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a lot more.
And depending on the, you know, if it's an empty shipping container,
yeah,
depending on how thick the metal is, I suppose that could be a ton.
Could be a ton.
But when I think about it, I think of like
the contents.
A full one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, if you're thinking about tons of plastic in the ocean or something like that, then it's not going to necessarily look the same as a cube of water.
No.
It's going to be...
Tiny bits of plastic.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it might be much bigger because plastic's pretty light. But I just thought that was very interesting. And I've spoken to other people since then who also did not know that a ton is a cubic meter of water. I'm sure everyone listening does, but
no.
On the off chance.
There you go. Imagine
I'm not ashamed
meter.
To say I didn't
That's
know.
A ton.
Yeah.
I think Eric G might have earned a commemorative plate.
Ooh, yeah, I think you're right. We'll give you a shout. Eric,
we'll email. We've got your email address here, Eric, because you put it on the problem posing page.
If you don't already have
solution.
One.
If you haven't already got one, we'll send you one. If you send us your spreadsheet. Simple exchange. Spreadsheet for bowl.
Or plate.
Plate. Bowl. Thank you so much for listening to A Problem Squared, episode 068. I'm now actually at home recording on my normal microphone. So for new listeners, this is the audio quality we normally adhere to. And I'm here because not only do we appreciate every single listener, the maximum amount possible, but we extra super maximum appreciate our Patreon supporters who make this whole enterprise function. And we pick three of them at random every single episode to thank. And I realized in the field, I didn't have enough internet access to download the current list of all Patreon supporters. So I've done that, now I'm home. And this time we'd like to thank Bernard Dieber. Bernard Dieber. Space Sloth. I think that's pronounced Space Sloth. Anne Jeffress. It's probably Jeffries. I'm going to go with Anne Jeffress. One syllable. Jeffress. Thank you so much to all our Patreon supporters and everyone who listens and reviews and stars and promotes this podcast. We couldn't do it without each and every single one. Well, we could. We just do it to a linear scaled less amount, but we appreciate you a huge amount. I'm Matt Parker. My co-host was Beck Hill, and the producer of this podcast is Lauren Armstrong Carter, who had to edit all that festival noise into a podcast. You know what? Now Beck's not here. I'm just going to say it. Cheezels are better than twisties. There you are. No one told Beck I said that.